Jim Fester, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today, as soon as we make our telephone connection, is a professor of psychology at the University of New Hampshire. His name is William Woodward, and he is among the academicians who have been subjected to harassment for their study of 9/11. In my opinion, this is an absurd situation. We have found it repeated in several other instances, including with Judy Wood, a professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University, who had more than 60 peer-reviewed articles as an assistant professor, and nevertheless was denied tenure by Clemson for her research on 9/11. Kevin Barrett from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who has been the most qualified candidate for positions in the state, including, for example, at Whitewater, where the other two candidates withdrew, and nevertheless, the university declined to make the appointment in spite of his credentials. And Stephen Jones at Brigham Young University, professor of physics, who was taken out of the classroom and placed on research assignment because of his studies of 9/11. All this is quite remarkable and at least faintly absurd. I mean, if you consider that the President of the United States regards 9/11 as the pivotal event of the 21st century, marking a difference between a before and after, that colleges and universities are the best positioned institutions to study these events, but yet that even though the government's own official account of 19 Islamic fundamentalists hijacking four commercial airliners, outfoxing the most sophisticated air defense system in the world, and perpetrating these atrocities under the control of a guy off in Afghanistan is itself a conspiracy theory. Faculty aren't supposed to study them. Well, if you can't study a conspiracy theory, since the government's own official account is one, then you can't study 9/11. I think that must be the point. Have we got our connection now, Bill? Are you with me?
I'm with you, Jim.
Hey, terrific. Great pleasure. I don't know how much of that intro you heard, but I was mentioning how you have been harassed in your appointment, and to me it's so completely absurd, given especially that one of your areas of research expertise is political psychology.
Right. Well, harass is the right word, but I think as we look at each case of professors attempting to do what they're paid to do, speak out to clarify the truth about the world, as you look at the details, you can see a lot of institutional pressures in play and a lot of psychological fear, and I think maybe that's what you'll get from me as a psychologist, more less on the facts of 9/11 and more on the psychology.
Haven't both the governor of your state and senators spoken out in criticism of your interest in 9/11?
This is true. I was quoted saying that government elites orchestrated 9/11. It was in a Sunday edition of the newspaper. And on that one statement, which was fed to them by the editors, they weighed in that I should be investigated or fired. I guess that is a form of harassment.
Well, I would think it is, Bill. you're the psychologist, but I suppose philosophers are maybe, pay a lot of attention to language. But I certainly think you have been harassed, and you, not you alone, mind you. Today, of course, I think one of the most remarkable phenomena taking place around the country is the outpouring of interest from so many different segments of professional elements of society, namely, if you go to patriotsquestion911.com, which I imagine most members of our audience are familiar with, you find now, maybe as many as 1,400 names of professionals from the military, the intelligence agencies, the government, pilots, experts, aeronautical engineers, structural engineers, mechanical engineers, physicists, the whole bit, not to mention across all the academic lines where you find the several hundred more. And then you got these pilots for 9/11 Truth, fascinating group, and a whole lot of pilots are signed on there. Architects and engineers, I think there's as many as 400 now, not to mention survivors, because, of course, like the rest of us, they're interested in knowing the truth about how their loved ones died on that day, and the government obviously hasn't told them.
Well, I guess one reason I don't feel personally attacked is that I think it's like the time of Galileo.
Mm-hmm.
A small number of people realized that the Earth was round, but the vast majority thought that the Earth was flat. And I think that's what we're dealing with. There's a lot of people out there who think the world is flat, and they have this belief system which flies in the face of science, but they're hanging on to it. Namely, the United States government could do no wrong. The conspiracy theory is too preposterous. Well, I don't want to get that word. That's an exercise in linguistics. But the official story is the safe story. They don't want to look beyond it.
Yes. Would you agree with my comparison to, a woman who finds indications that her husband has been molesting their daughter and it's so traumatizing she can't bring herself to confront it, so she denies or suppresses it, a phenomenon, I take it, known as cognitive dissonance?
Well, I would call that repression of a traumatic memory, and it's certainly a good example of how strongly one can deny something that happened. Holocaust survivors, for example, often don't tell their children about it. They refuse to talk about the past because it was so traumatic. This was, I guess, in most people's mind, a traumatic national event. But they don't want to take the time to look up to Google 9/11 Truth or Patriots Question 9/11, or to open a book. Oh my God, to open a book by David Ray Griffin? That would be too much to ask of a professor or an educated layman.
It's really fascinating, isn't it, how emotions and attitudes can override logic and evidence, how rationality is a trait that we may acquire and be capable of exercising in certain very specific domains, but not necessarily in the other areas of our life.
Right, right. We're all subject to processes. Now, cognitive dissonance is interesting. A classic book by Leon Festinger had religious group in Kansas predicting that some messianic event was going to happen. And so the social scientists studied them up until the hour when the event was predicted to happen. It didn't happen. They felt a lot of cognitive dissonance. It was supposed to have happened, but it didn't happen. And so then the question is, what do you do when your predictions aren't fulfilled? I don't know if this fits 9/11 or not, but what that group of religious extremists did was to say, well, it's going to happen at another date in the future. In other words, they reduced the dissonance by trying to get some kind of harmony. Now, do you see an attempt to reduce dissonance, get a harmonic view of the world in the case of 9/11?
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, William Woodward. This is Jim Fetzer, your host of the Dynamic Duo. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today, William Woodward, is a professor of psychology at the University of New Hampshire and an active member of 9/11 research community, and he has a special interest in psychological aspects, unsurprisingly. Bill, I'm very interested in your observations about the mechanisms the government's been using to try to keep the myth alive.
See, what I experienced was the mechanisms to suppress dissent. As soon as the headline about my dissent entered the media on the fifth anniversary of 9/11, September 11, 2006, I experienced pressures from my institution conveyed by my chair and my dean to become silent. And as the weeks went by, I learned that one reason for this was that parents were calling in saying they would not contribute to the endowment fund until Woodward was investigated or fired.
Really? And you're the man who came on the show saying you weren't subject to harassment.
I know. I'm a mild-mannered academic who's unaware of political realities. The second thing that happened was that I discovered indirectly that a letter had come from the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, otherwise known as Lynn Cheney.
Yes. She's a busy little beaver.
Yeah, and this is a front organization by the vice president's wife to remind boards of trustees of their duty, which is to investigate troublemakers such as myself.
Troublemakers.
And everybody seemed to accept that assumption. Well, not everybody, because with the enlightened resistance of a peace activist provost, to my good fortune, Bruce Mallory from the Education Department had been spotted in previous years on the buses to Washington and New York as a peace protester. But now, in his capacity as provost, he had the duty to go to the Board of Trustees and make a recommendation. In the face of a letter from the front organization for Lynn Cheney. And apparently his stance convinced a majority of the trustees that Woodward was already being investigated annually through his annual report and his dean's and department chair's judgment of that report, not to mention that every single student does an evaluation of the professor. No red flags had come up in 33 years of service. That was the winning argument.
No red flags in 33 years of service.
But apparently a strong minority, egged on by the governor and some senators, felt that I should be investigated. So this is a social psychological process that goes on. Some are frightened, and some say, wow, here's a chance to stand up for looking into the truth. Then in my fan mail, I would say it was, I got over 100 letters of congratulation. I was delivered a plant, which turned out to be a sticky plant, and the woman said, we are encouraging you to stick to your guns, Professor Woodward.
Oh, that's cute. That's dear.
Yeah, so it was very gratifying, the feedback that I did get, but then there were the cowards who didn't reply to my face, but to the endowment organization. there was very little criticism among the letters to the editor. The predominant feeling was, wow, this guy's a truth hero. However, most of the commentary in the newspapers and the radio, I was interviewed numerous times, was, wow, this guy's wacky. So the media, we have to look into why are the media participating, colluding in this gigantic cover-up? None of the media asked Professor Woodward, why? What is the evidence for your statement that government elites orchestrated 9/11? None of them. Instead, they said, are you really teaching this in the classroom? Do you think you have a right to frighten students with this kind of nonsense? Or are you really an espouser of the no planes theory or the Pentagon theory, this, that, and the other? They had a nice way of spinning it to make me look silly rather than to pursue the truth.
You know what's interesting about that, Bill, is that they knew how to spin it. I mean, that requires a certain amount of inside information, it seems to me, to have the, you know, at hand a way to twist an area of inquiry that presumably they had not studied themselves to know how to do that. I'm very fascinated by that.
Well, we do know that this administration issues talking points on a myriad of issues to its henchmen. Have you read that?
So they got a mass dissemination list to all reporters all over the country in all probability, then?
Yeah.
That would be the only thing to do, wouldn't it?
And its minions are told how to reply to any given issue. Let's say now it's the Iraq issue. A few years ago it was the Social Security issue. And I could go to my congressman, Jeb Bradley, and bing, bing, bing. He would knock off the points which he actually mentioned come from the Republican National Committee. So I think they have an extraordinary system of loyalty and ways of enforcing this, which remind me of my study of the Third Reich. They have a way of enforcing self-censorship on the press, on academia, and on the public.
Well, I'll tell you, your studies of the Third Reich, I think, are going to be, you know, ought to offer a lot of illumination about what we're going through. I mean, you must find it unnerving day by day to see this military police state grow in power and influence.
Oh, it's frightening, but for me, the most calming thing is to get information and to weigh it. My students say, well, how do you know what's true and what isn't? Well, you use your head. And read as much as you can from different sources.
Yeah.
Sources like Truthout or Antiwar.com, sure, they're out on one wing, the left wing, perhaps. I also subscribe to the Wall Street Journal. I'm perfectly happy to weigh what they say against the Wall Street Journal.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
And I often spend time listening to what some harebrained like Rush Limbaugh has to say just to see how it's being spun.
Hats off to you. I'm willing to go.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest, William Woodward. Stand by. Your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today, William Woodward, is a professor of psychology at the University of New Hampshire and an active student of 9/11, especially in relation to its psychological and political aspects. Bill, while I got you here, this opportunity, please, could you draw out some of those basic comparisons with the Third Reich? I think that everyone needs to understand what's going on is entirely serious and has a well-defined precursor historically.
Well, there's a novel about the Third Reich by a German woman who got her master's in writing at the University of New Hampshire. Her name is Ursula Hegge, H-E-G-G-I. First, I don't have the title of the novel on the tip of my tongue, but it describes small-town events as Hitler took over in 1933 on up to 1945. It shows how people basically, when scary things were happening on the streets, such as arresting a Jewish person or burning a book, or ultimately shipping people out of the town one by one, or in larger groups, people would close their curtains. This is something that's easy to do in a condo like they have in Germany. You just shut out the world. Obviously, you didn't want to get in trouble by going out and being associated with the event. I think that metaphor applies to the United States today. Most people pull down their curtains, won't even Google the subject. And the vehemence with which they resist information suggests a deeper fear that there might be something to it.
How has the government been so successful in manipulating this situation?
They've been hiring social scientists, including people of my own field, psychology, to work with the CIA ever since World War II. The Department of Defense, NSF, are some of the biggest funders of the of social science. That doesn't mean there's very many of these people who've been co-opted, but there are enough to, for example, talk about how to spread propaganda to the mass media. That's been actively studied, and there are those turncoats who work for industry. And I think that's a very highly tuned profession right now. It's called advertising. But we know that the Iraq War was advertised. An old-fashioned word for that is propaganda.
Promoted by the use of the manipulation of information in order to deceive and mislead.
Right. We've heard it said that the media get information straight from the Pentagon now, particularly on Fox News, but it gets around about what they're supposed to say, what's the party line about, for example, blockade against Iran.
An insane idea, which, of course, is historically an act of war.
What you don't see is a discussion, historical discussion, of what do sovereign states do when their neighbor develops a nuclear program, runs an apartheid regime for 60 years, uses cluster bombs in a recent war in Lebanon. What are they supposed to do?
And we're, of course, talking about Israel, our closest ally, which now today with the United States is the most despised and reviled country in the world.
Why don't we get another perspective on that nonsense? Why don't we hear Rand's point of view, which is self-defense? Of course, in this instance, we're talking about the right of a sovereign country to have a peaceful nuclear energy program.
Yes.
And we're not talking about the assault on the dollar, which may be what's really going on.
Switching from petrodollars to petro-euros and other currencies.
I believe Saddam was one of the first to say, I prefer euros to dollars, and he paid for it, and I believe Iran has made the same move. So in a sense, this comes down to a lot of hype about nuclear weapons when it's really an underlying economic war.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. What did you think of the sanctification of the official account in the National Cathedral when Bush has, you know, a priest and a rabbi and a minister present, and he says we must not talk about or entertain outrageous conspiracy theories?
Oh, I think that's capitulation by people who should stand up. Too bad. I heard on YouTube yesterday, I listened to a clip from Bill Clinton. What was he saying about 9/11? He was saying, how dare they entertain these outrageous conspiracy theories?
It was incredible that he would say something like that. Bill Clinton, for God's sake?
I thought he was a person of great knowledge and wisdom. But he also has cultivated the ability to stay within the realms of power, close pal of George Bush Sr. And I guess he and his wife know what side the bread is buttered on. But surely these people know better.
Well, I've been disgusted by their role in this campaign and the below-the-belt tactics they've used and the distortion and deception. And now after South Carolina, Bill Clinton tried to trivialize what Barack Obama was doing by suggesting it was basically just a black campaign, comparing it to Jesse Jackson's efforts in the past, which were significant in their own right, but here was a figure who was transcending racial stereotypes and making a significant national appeal, and Bill Clinton was undermining it, thereby defeating the objectives of the party and the interests of the nation for the sake of his own self-serving welfare.
Well, we could broaden that point to the Democrats in general. Why are the Democrats now voting for the Iran blockade?
Bill, you know, I heard a speculation by Tom Hartman on Air America just last week where he was talking about trying to understand the conduct of Nancy Pelosi, this whole FISA thing and the telecommunications giants. I mean, if they actually think somebody's in contact with a terrorist, they obviously have the ability to intercept those conversations, but they don't know who's a terrorist. They consider you and me to be possible terrorists. They've been listening to everyone's conversation, intercepting everyone's email, and doing it for domestic political reasons, and I'm convinced of that. And Hartman was speculating that perhaps they just had goods, you know, on Nancy Pelosi. This is, they could have goods on almost every American, and we're blackmailing her into being cooperative lest they, you know, subject her to public humiliation.
I think that blackmail threat is being used broadly among congressmen. I hate to mention the American-Israeli Public Action Committee, but they've been all out. And our number one issue, I'm told, is Iran.
Yeah. They've been insane about it, in my opinion, absolutely insane. And, you know, Lieberman has been so disgusting. I mean, I consider him to be a major traitor, not just to the Democratic Party, but to the United States of America. In fact, there turned out to be a whole set of these neoconservatives who have joint Israeli-U.S. citizenship, Bill. It's really shocking to me how much the government has been infested by persons whose loyalty to another nation may exceed their loyalty to the United States.
Well, one could certainly make a strong case for that. The Project for New American Century had some people of mixed loyalties, for sure.
This whole business seems to go back quite a ways as far as, you know, wanting to benefit Israel. I think that it was the first Cheney-Rumsfeld collaboration under Gerald Ford with Henry Kissinger that laid the foundation for what would become these wars in the Middle East. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, William Woodward. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. You can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today, William Woodward, is a professor of psychology at the University of New Hampshire and a student of 9/11. Bill, I'm very interested in drawing out some of those parallels with the Third Reich again. You were talking about how the citizens reacted with fear and just shut themselves off from what was going on around them. But what do you take to be the most important parallels in terms of the government subversion of democratic process and all that?
Well, to co-opt the opinion leaders, the elites that are educated, how did the Third Reich do that? How did they get Martin Heidegger, for example, to support their cause? They got him to, he wanted to be the rector or the chancellor of the University of Heidelberg. And he would write in a kind of coded language about racial theory, just suggesting by the nuances in his philosophy that he sided with the fascist leadership of the country. And that paved the way to his institutional leadership and his role in society as being a... So he kept his job. Others, such as Wolfgang Kurler at Berlin, the psychologist, defended their Jewish students who were being dismissed and paid the price of being humiliated, attacked, and forced out of the country. And between those extremes of resistance and cooperation, accommodation, you have the entire leadership of a country. I'm sure it was happening in the banking business, insurance business. In my field of psychology, there's a recent dual biography of two ethologists. Ethologists study animal behavior in natural settings. One was the Dane Nico Tinbergen. The other was the Austrian Konrad Lorenz. I wonder if you, Jim, are have you heard of those figures, and could you guess which one sided with the Nazis?
Well, Konrad Lorenz, I would think, would his study of evolution and aggression in animals and all that,
right.
I don't know. I think he would have a broad perspective and would not side with the Nazis.
But. In fact, he was the one that did side with the Nazis.
Really?
He found a way to couch his work so that he was acceptable and his career would be advanced.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Nico Tinbergen was a courageous Dane.
Yes.
And these two guys were close friends, but they had a little bit of a parting of the way for a number of years there. Over their political differences. Denmark, of course, was invaded by the Nazis. It was not an easy position to take. So one thing I'm learning from the study of resistance to the Nazis is that the price of resistance in this country is not as harsh as it was in Europe in the 1930s and 40s. We still, at very little cost to our careers, can speak out. It's true. Some of us have been harassed. Some of us have been forced out of academia with early retirements. But it's not like imprisonment or shooting, which is the fate of many resistors in the Third Reich. Therefore, I think there should be more civil courage in this country, more than I'm seeing.
But isn't it the case that maybe we're just not quite to that stage yet? I'm looking at an article in sfgate.com entitled Rule by Fear or Rule by Law by Lewis Sellier and Dan Hamburg. I'll just read a couple paragraphs for us to kick this off. Since 9/11, and seemingly without the notice to most Americans, the federal government has assumed the authority to institute martial law, arrest a wide swath of dissidents, citizens and non-citizens alike, and detain people without legal or constitutional recourse in the event of, quote, an emergency influx of immigrants to the U.S. or to support the rapid development of new programs, end quote. Beginning in 1999, the government has entered into a series of single-bid contracts with Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root to build detention camps at undisclosed locations within the United States. The government has also contracted with several companies to build thousands of rail cars, some reportedly equipped with shackles, ostensibly to transport detainees. I find that all fairly unnerving.
I would like to echo what you just read. I've read it, too. I've circulated it to my mailing list. I think you're onto something. Now, most of us don't even want to contemplate what that implies.
Well, I think it implies you and I may be offering tutorials to selected groups in outdoor environments in the near future. I mean, I wish I thought there were no more to it than that.
Yeah, it's very scary what evidence there is already of preparations for martial law and for the detention of people who are allegedly linked to terrorism, but in fact are seeking a peaceful world.
You know, it seemed to me, Bill, that this militarization is going on piecemeal around the country. They'll have a big sweep, you know, in one community, and they'll round up, you know, 100 people on different kinds of warrants. Maybe they're not paying their alimony. They take their computers, and they claim they're going to study them to see if they have any terrorist connections. It's almost with a wink and a nod. You have the Massachusetts State Police, I understand, go to all-black uniforms to be more intimidating. You're pulling these operations in various communities around the country, like Portland and Seattle and most recently Denver, where the military is present in significant number, performing
right.
operations in the past that were illegal under posse comitatus, separation between police functions in the military. I think that this is just going on all around us, like the frog in the pot, who with temperature kept going up 1 degree at a time. He didn't even realize he was being cooked.
And what's the solution? I'm saying civil courage to speak out. Write a letter to the editor. Wear your 9/11 T-shirt. Talk about it in your classroom. Unfortunately, though, my colleagues are very nose to the grindstone of their discipline. and there's no concept of citizenship and of the purpose of academic freedom, which is to preserve a free society, I thought.
Isn't that fascinating, Bill? You know, like in my whole career, I knew practically no other faculty member until I met, you know, the like of you who understood what tenure was all about. I mean, I've used it as an opportunity to speak out and criticize the government and investigate a lot of controversial issues like the death of JFK and the plane crash that took the life of Senator Paul Wellstone. But most of my colleagues would cringe at the very idea, you know. Their greatest fear is embarrassment, and they just aren't going to go there.
No, they aren't. Well, to the credit of my provost, he sponsored a colloquium on academic freedom 6 months after the firestorm about me. And there we heard that we, from a variety of experts, I think he was learning as much as we were, from a variety of experts, that our academic freedom extends within our teaching appointment. So an engineer is expected to teach about engineering, but he really isn't expected to give his political views. What do you think about that? How far can a philosopher or a psychologist then enter into the domain of public events?
Well, the great thing about, you know, like I teach these courses in critical thinking, I had the opportunity really to discuss anything under the sun because it can all be analyzed critically. I used to go on when the administration was making these arguments for the war in Iraq and just dismember them one after another as illustrations.
Mm-hmm.
And I
okay.
talked extensively about 9/11. But you know, and I have even described my research on JFK and Paul Wellstone and even 9/11 as a form of applied philosophy, insofar as the philosophy involves reasoning to try to discover truth.
That's excellent. I don't know of any philosopher doing that. I want to know more. But essentially, that's my approach in psychology, to weave it into the psychology of race. Why do we think of Arabs as people we should fear? It's a stereotype.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, William Woodward. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson. Over the years, Genesis Communications Network has grown by leaps and bounds, reaching millions of listeners. The impact on political and social issues have been enormous. Businesses associated with the network have grown to become valuable enterprises. If you are accredited and have an entrepreneurial spirit, national radio may be the opportunity you're looking for. Call me today at 877-996-4327, extension 101.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest today, William Woodward from the University of New Hampshire. Just to read another couple paragraphs from Rule by Fear or Rule by Law, which I'm sure you can all find by Google, just put in Rule by Fear or Rule by Law question mark. Section 1042 of the 2007 National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, use of the armed forces in major public emergencies, gives the executive the power to invoke martial law. For the first time in more than a century, the president is now authorized to use military response in response to, quote, a natural disaster, a disease outbreak, a terrorist attack, or any other condition in which the president determines that domestic violence has occurred to the extent that state officials cannot maintain public order, end quote. The Military Commissions Act of 2006 ran through Congress just before the 2006 midterm elections, allows for the indefinite imprisonment of anyone who donates money to a charity that turns up on a list of terrorist organizations or who speaks out against the government's policies. The law calls for secret trials for citizens and non-citizens alike. I don't know, Bill, speaking out against the government's policies, that sounds like a hazardous pastime with this administration.
Absolutely. Not enough people know about the Military Commissions Act or the NDAA. So I'm glad you gave me a source to learn about it myself and to spread the bad news. Rule by fear and rule of by law.
And then, you know, we have the further step with this Representative Harmon, Jane Harmon from Los Angeles County, has come up with a new way to expand the war on terror with the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007, which passed the House, Bill, can you believe this, by the vote of 404-6, which would set up a commission to examine and report on the facts and causes of so-called violent radicalism and extremist ideology. I mean, you know, this is really something she's targeting at anyone who doesn't think the way she thinks.
Yep, and of course it's targeted at Quakers, peace activists, 9/11 truth seekers, isn't it?
Absolutely. Anyone who's criticizing the government.
Yep.
Anti-taxers, I think, are included, anti-war activists. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. I mean, you know, what's happened in the United States of America, Bill? It's not the country you and I grew up in.
Well, having lived for 5 years in Germany and coming to realize that Germans are human, too, it can happen to any country. Dictatorial regimes happened in Germany, in China, and they're happening here. Join the societies who are ruled by despots. And only, unfortunately, because of the high education and development of this country, they're doing it in a very, very soft fascist way, to the point where it's in the media and people don't recognize it.
Soft fascism, that's a nice phrase.
Every time my bags are checked at an airport and they pull out the shampoo and say, no, you can't take this, I'm thinking, wow, this government has really perfected the technique of instilling fear of terrorism. They're educating us in a myth to be afraid of the boogeyman.
I mean, this is based upon that raid in the suburbs of London where they claimed that these so-called terrorists were going to concoct a bomb aboard a plane, and it turned out they didn't have the ingredients, they didn't have tickets, they didn't even have any plans to come to the United States, they didn't have passports, that concocting this stuff would require very elaborate equipment, very delicate measurements, and it would create a tremendous stink and take hours to do.
Yeah, so
you and I aren't allowed to take Head and Shoulders aboard a plane?
But this is deliberately constructed to give us a false view of the world, which is that we should fear terrorism. What we should fear is the secret government in our own midst.
Every time I go through this security check in an airport, I think about the absurdity of it all, because it's such a waste of time and money and effort when the whole business is concocted and fabricated. I mean, the number of terrorists in the United States has to be minuscule, tiny, tiny number. In fact, you know, all the evidence we have of the government's complicity in 9/11 indicates that the real terrorists are actually in Washington, D.C. in prominent positions.
Well, have you given a reading list to your listeners? I first became aware in a Quaker reading group as we decided to read Michael Rupert, Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the World in the Age of Oil. And there it pointed to the role of our own vice president in taking over the Secret Service and the military and being the linchpin of the 9/11 planning.
Yeah.
That was a shockaroo. But that led to reading David Ray Griffin and Webster Copley.
Yes.
And then Jack Maher, I believe.
Jim.
So many good books. If you Google
the number one, Bill, you may have not picked up yet, Peter Dale Scott's The Road to 9/11 is brilliant.
Good. Another good one.
It's really talking about how, you know, the country has evolved to become a corporate state.
Yeah. The Road to 9/11. So if you go to Amazon and put in any of these titles, they'll give you a picture of the cover of a dozen other books on the same subject. So we really have no excuse for not knowing what's going on if we care about the truth. There's lots of well-documented information. We'd be talking about how the banks cooperated. We'd be talking about how the air controllers' tapes were confiscated. We could talk about where the videotapes of the Pentagon. We could talk about the simulated hijackings on 9/11, a dozen of them, to confuse the air traffic controllers. There's so much evidence, and trained as a historian of science, as I am, you're trained to look for a pattern in complexity. So when people say, what's the most important evidence to go study, I'd say, get a book and look at the complexity.
Yes. And, of course, another great book, if you want to understand the relationship between the United States and the world, is John Perkins' The Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Oh, my, from our own state of New Hampshire.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. A Peace Corps, former Peace Corps volunteer, like myself, who put his Spanish language training to a diabolical use in fomenting blackmailing foreign leaders and telling them we will invade your country if you don't go along with this loan from the World Bank, or we'll assassinate you or your relatives. Terrible.
Yeah, which basically we proceed to do in short order.
Which we have done in case after case.
I know, it's absolutely stunning. You read the history of the CIA. Just go online and do a history of the CIA. It's completely stunning and shocking.
Yeah. So this is what we should be teaching in civics classes. But what school board will allow this? And that goes back to self-censorship and the Third Reich. People are afraid to examine touchy subjects.
And yet those touchy subjects, really the complex and controversial ones, are, in my opinion, the only ones worth discussing.
Right. So how do we go back to 1775 and free ourselves from the tyranny in our midst? The British Empire is the White House, but is the cooperation with corporate leaders and media. Have to expose them.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, William Woodward. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. On the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today, William Woodward, is a professor of psychology at the University of New Hampshire. Bill, I'm looking at a piece entitled, As America Collapses, U.S. Government Secret Plans Revealed. I've seen a version of it before. It claims that there have been secret meetings in the House of Representatives and the Senate, some mass meeting of the Senate, all of our officials, during which they were told of a sequence of events that's taking place right now. Here, according to this article, is what was told to them. The U.S. economy faces imminent collapse that will occur sometime in late 2008. That's, of course, very plausible. that the U.S. government finances faces imminent collapse sometime in mid-2009, that as a result of this collapse, there's the real possibility of civil war within the United States, that there is going to be an advanced roundup of insurgent U.S. citizens who might be likely to move against the government, that the in order to detain them, the REX 84 camps have been constructed throughout the United States, that there's the possibility of public retaliation against members of Congress because of these collapses. Consequently, there are safe facilities that have been designed for members of Congress and their families to reside during civic unrest, that these occasions will be used to justify the merger of the United States with Canada and Mexico to establish the North American Union, where the new currency called the Amero will be issued for all three as an economic solution. And I have no doubt that, you know, Chinese dollars might somehow turn out not to be convertible into Amero's bill. But, you know, a lot of these pieces are lying around, and this is an attempt to make systematic sense of them, and I invite your comments.
Well, I read this report. Nico Haupt, I believe, is one of the sources. I'm frightened of this. I have people in my community who are learning self-defense schools from self-defense techniques from Native Americans for survival in the woods. They think that we're going to be reduced to what is described in the wake of the Civil War as sort of fleeing from our posses and gangs of armies and trying to survive in the woods. And they're serious. These are former Mormons, by the way. Mormons and Quakers. I find it's hard, though, to take seriously these reports and to begin to do something about it. Doing something about it would mean, for example, trying to get my retirement account into gold and silver so that I would have something when the economy collapsed. And there are discussions in many community sustainability groups about just this issue. What is a safe form of resource? Is it money in your safety deposit box when the banks collapse, or is it money in your basement? Is it currency? Is it gems? A friend who survived the transition in Cuba when Castro came along says that they survived on precious metals for 6 years. Precious metals enabled them to buy a goat, to raise chickens, and to eke out an existence when the economy collapsed. Are you aware of groups like this who are seriously studying how to survive?
Who want to say that this is the way to cope with a pending problem?
Well,
you know, this network is even built around precious metals. You know, Genesis is the backbone of it, is the precious metals market, so...
We recommend going to solari.com, S-O-L-A-R-I.com.
So these are recommendations you endorse?
Little group, that's all. Our little group has studied Catherine Austin Fitz, who has been, she's the former Assistant Secretary of HUD, HUD, under Reagan, I believe, or maybe it was the senior Bush. She knows a lot about Wall Street, where she started. And she feels there's been so much criminal activity in the highest levels of the economy that the dollar is going to collapse. And we need to start to rebuild local economies, the kind we had in the 19th century, where you invest in your local store and your local farmer, where the bank is something that's owned by the community. Keep the money circulating within the community. So we've done that. We've researched our local banks and found the ones which keep the money local, rather than contributing to the banking system, keep the money circulating in our own community. So Solari is my recommendation for a way to begin to protect your family and friends.
Solari.com.
Yep.
Well, I'm going to have to visit.
She wrote the introduction to Michael Rupert, too, their pals. She's completely aware of the 9/11 movement, and that's part of the context of corruption that has gotten into the seats of power.
Because, Bill, when it all falls to hell, you know, I just, I've been at a loss as to what should be done. So maybe here you have some clues. Why don't you repeat that that capsule summary list you have just offered?
Well, I've said that to learn how to handle your savings, go to the website of Catherine Austin Fitts, F-I-T-T-S, called Solari.com. Solari is a word for the sun, S-O-L-A-R-I.com.
Yes.
You could spend more than one session in a local group, a church group, or whatever, studying her recommendations. She's even going on local, national tours. She's available as a speaker or as a conference call person. Then if you're community-minded, many of us are meeting and reading a Swedish book called The Natural Step, which is talking about what Swedish communities have done from the bottom up to prepare for the end of oil and to create a sustainable community. Sewage, toxic waste, energy, farming, all of those are efforts to make your community independent of oil.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, William Woodward. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.
This is the GCN Radio Network, home to Hard Talk Radio.
Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is William Woodward, a professor of psychology from the University of New Hampshire. You know, Bill, thinking about some of your suggestions there, it seems to me that, you know, close community involvement, interaction, forms of barter, and all that sort of thing are wonderful alternatives that may be especially appealing in the small towns of New England. So, you know, I'm wondering whether you don't have inherent advantages in coping with the disaster that appears to be about to befall us.
Well, that may be. They say New England is characterized by local rule, the belief that communities should make their own decisions. We have town government, and we have town administrators who serve at the behest of the Board of Select Persons, as opposed to what I'm told in the Midwest is a model where you hire a town administrator to administer the town. Our ministers administer the decisions of a lay group of seven or nine persons. But beyond that, I think movements like the Carbon Challenge out here to reduce your carbon footprint, that starts with little citizens groups. Two women scientists at our university launched that effort. Some of these are church-based. The churches that typically get involved are not even churches. The Quaker Meeting and the Unitarian Fellowship, either one of which calls itself a church. But then they come from other faith groups as well. Many of us have been interpreting Christianity very broadly as doing unto others as you'd like them to do to you. How do we build community? And a lot of people are worried about, you know, what kind of transportation they're going to be using over the next 30 years, how they're going to heat their houses. We sit down and we form a curriculum of 10 weeks with books, speakers, and films. And then we get about 20 to 30 people coming to these events because it's formed into a little curriculum. And then at the end of 10 weeks, we sit down and we design another 10-week curriculum. this is something any community could do. I don't know if the West and Midwest is doing this. It takes leadership, and each of us is also thinking about back in our hometown. This is a regional effort in a Quaker meeting house that serves about six communities. I think many of us come from other faith communities and other towns where we're beginning to spread the word by using this book, The Natural Step for Communities. The word that we're most concerned about right now is how to transform our towns, the transportation system, the agricultural system, in ways that are sustainable, that is, that do not take chemicals out of the earth, that do not put dangerous chemicals back into the earth, that do not hurt animals, and that are fair for humans. Basic principles, which we apply to every walk in our lives. And it comes from case examples, case studies in Sweden, as translated by Sarah James, J-A-M-E-S, who's an American community planner who went to Sweden to find out what they were doing to get away from fossil fuel and to design ecological housing and green businesses. So there are many of us who have left the 9/11 issue behind, unfortunately, because we think the time is running out to get ready for a sustainable future. We just need to put 9/11 behind us. I wear my 9/11 T-shirt, and I like to engage people in conversation, but I am also involved in trying to construct a more healthy world from the ground up.
Yeah.
Do you have anything like that going on in Minnesota?
Well, I'm now down in Madison, but it's it's a hop, skip, and a jump, and I wish I felt there was more community concern about all the threats we face. I mean, every time Bush comes out and speaks on television, it seems to have a soporific effect. Everyone realizes he's ridiculous. I think his constant reemergence is supposed to make him appear to be relevant, even though he's in this extreme lame duck status, but he's still in the position to make matters worse. And in short order, if we wind up attacking Iran, Bill, by God, things are going to be so much worse, it's going to be unimaginable that we were ever in the situation we were in before they became so catastrophic. It's that bad.
Oh, it's very bad. Your radio station was just talking about the Chinese economic threat, which I could see would be justified, which is to get rid of their dollars.
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes I think the United States is such a menace to the world that we have become not only the greatest aggressor state, but the greatest terrorist state, that maybe, an economic collapse of the country would be a good thing in terms of the long-term interests of the world.
Well, we'd shape up and learn some lessons about poverty, make us more empathetic with the huge poverty rate.
The third world, which we've been exploiting for so long. Something I don't understand about globalization, Bill, maybe this has occurred to you too, is when we transfer all these jobs, for $14 an hour jobs from the U.S. to $1.40 jobs in Thailand, for example, we lose all that economic power those $14 an hour jobs created in a middle class and in a working class that was able to have all that discretionary income and buy those televisions and those nice cars and everything else. The guy making $1.40 in Thailand's not going to be buying the televisions and nice cars. So the whole process is eventually going to bring an end to the profits of these corporations. I even had Paul Craig Roberts, a former assistant Secretary of the Treasury, on to discuss this, and he confirmed my opinion, and he told me that he'd been trying to explain this to corporate leaders, and they wouldn't listen.
Oh, dear. Well, Bill Clinton touched it off in the mid-90s, the free trade movement. And
I know I worry about this Clinton guy. I used to hold him in high esteem, and today I guess it would be more accurate to say I despise him.
Yep, he's a smooth talker, but it's more of the same. I was in India last November, December, at a conference. It was called Anti-Imperialism Conference. And they got out over 10,000 people on the street. Many youth were there. and they were holding signs, down with the USA, down with imperialism, and down with Israel. It got me to thinking, what do these three entities have in common? And their concern, they were really not interested in hearing my pre-announced talk on 9/11. And so I switched talks. I talked about the U.S. peace movement. I wanted them to know that there's another side to the multinational corporations which are infesting their country with so-called free economic zones.
Yeah.
Or special economic zones.
Yeah.
There had just been a government-paid goons in a town called Nandigram, 50 miles from Calcutta, in the spring of 2008, which had cleared the land of the peasant farmers. And, of course, it was a big multinational pharmaceutical firm that was scheduled to come in there. Ramsey Clark came to our conference. On the second day, he made an automobile trip, police escort to Nandigram, and the result was that the pharmaceutical company backed off.
Really?
We need to expose special economic zones and support the efforts of people who see through corporatism.
Stunning thought that anyone is speaking up for anyone or getting anywhere about it. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays. And I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today, with whom I am concluding a conversation that I hope to extend in the future, William Woodward, is a professor of psychology from the University of New Hampshire, who's very interested in issues of 9/11, but also in the survival of the American population, Bill, if I might put it that way, because I really think we're in desperate shape.
Well, we need moral support, social support from one another, and we're trying to begin here by just building communities to learn how to install rain barrels, for example, so that we'll have water. That came out of organizing against the purchase of our aquifer by a multinational. I have a neighbor, several neighbors who are raising chickens. They had to get permission from the abutters, but they're actually able to do it in a college town suburb. We're learning gardening skills, canning skills. We're supporting our local bicycle shop. We've learned from an agricultural professor that the best way to transform agriculture is to support your local farmer, even if the prices are a little higher. So that he can make ends meet. In our case, we already buy yogurt, milk, butter, and eggs from a local farmer. And this, by going local, we're forming a community of those who understand how to get beyond a technological society and back to an interlocking agricultural society.
It may be that is the direction in which the future lies, Bill, you know, that we're going to have to revert to what we thought were more primitive forms of life.
Well, I think more and more people are catching on to this. Do you still have dairy farms within walking distance of Madison?
Yeah, well, walking distance.
Biking distance.
There's a big department of dairy science here in Wisconsin, and cheese is still our greatest product.
Good.
But I'll tell you, yeah, I like the rural life. I really do. It's wonderful.
Well, we have to cope with snow. Do you have to cope with snow?
Oh, God, yes, we do. not quite like it was in Duluth, Bill, where we had like 29 inches one Halloween shortly after Jen and I moved there back in 1987.
Oh, that's farther north, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Down here, we've had, I mean, we might have, you know, a third of that on occasion. Seems to hang around a long time, but, you know, I envy the small-town atmosphere in which you thrive in New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine. These are wonderful places to live.
Well, I'm a Midwesterner at heart, you know. Milwaukee, German immigrants are one of my origins. Belleville, Ontario, farm country is another.
Oh, really?
West Lafayette, Indiana is my mom's home. And I go there on family reunions. I've thought of retiring to the Midwest, where I thought it was cheaper to buy a house and cost of living. Is that not true? live in a trailer where it's accepted to live in trailers, on a pond.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think each region has something to offer the other.
Yes. Well, I think this idea of barter may make a resurgence, but I'm also terribly concerned about the use of these detention facilities, that we're going to see soldiers in every community, that our lives are never going to be the same, that fear is going to become so dominant that none of us are going to be able to speak our minds. That,
well,
programs like this one, Bill, are going to be shut down.
Every day I send out two emails, and the detention camps have been one of them. And I try to slant them toward what we can do, again, to build up a little bit of morale. Sign up on a petition to stop the Iran assault. Sign up on a petition to support impeachment. Something you can do today to make yourself and your world a better place.
Yes. Yes. keep doing those little things in the hope that enough of the little things are going
right.
to add up. But
you're right. It's very, very scary, and I think a lot of people are frightened. But we need leadership to tell them what is a helpful response.
Yeah, and where's it coming at the national level? You know, the Democratic Party seems to have capitulated. I don't know if they're all blackmailed, but they're certainly turning out to be gutless wonders.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think a book like The Israel Lobby is a good one to study. I think there's a lot of blackmail, also corporate blackmail. Maybe get to know your congresspeople and find out what pressures they're under. Do you have town hall meetings where a candidate or House of Representative person will come and talk to you?
You know, I haven't figured that out yet. I've been here not long enough, but it's a great question.
I've been in local public office, and I really appreciate it when people speak out and give you feedback. If they don't have time to read the emails and the alternative press that we're reading. So I think if I were a better patriot, I'd be packaging information for my elected representatives. Judd Gregg and John Sununu, two Republicans, need a lot of educating about the impact of their policies. Fortunately, our representatives are more anti-war, and we're proud of them. But again,
that's very good.
Yeah, you're an educator. I'm an educator.
we need more of these anti-war. We need more understanding that the truth about 9/11 completely destroys any justification for these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which are in violation of international law, the UN Charter, and even the U.S. Constitution.
Absolutely right. Kucinich yesterday launched another impeachment resolution. This one based on the simple fact that there have been fraudulent evidence used to start a war. That's sort of the bottom line ground for impeachment.
Yeah.
Surely we should all be on the impeachment bandwagon.
Of course. Of course, and it's disgusting how when the Democrats regained power, Nancy Pelosi announced that impeachment and defunding the war were off the table when those were the two biggest clubs in our bag.
Yep. Well, I guess she and John Conyers felt the constituencies weren't behind them. But from what I read from Conyers, he's now hinting that it is, and Pelosi has allowed the Kucinich effort to go forward. So there's tepid support.
I think that's got to be because they have been subjected to so much criticism from grassroots Democrats.
Uh-huh.
Or Republicans, you know, people who care about the government. If you care about integrity of government, you have to be, have reached a point of extreme nausea every time you contemplate Bush or Cheney.
Well, the 9/11 group, as you'll see in Patriots Question 9/11, is bipartisan. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, absolutely, across the board.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that, but that's one of the initial points one needs to make.
Yes.
This is
yes,
a criminal
I
government.
Agree more, Bill.
We need to expose the crimes, treat it like a crime scene, and stop the cover-up, which includes lots and lots of Democrats, lots and lots of media who are suppressing good information on the subject. Yeah, I really applaud what you're doing, getting on the radio. That's terrific. It makes me want to get on the Portsmouth Public Radio.
Good, Bill. I think more and more, you know, more of us get on and just have the opportunity to express our opinion. I mean, it at least provokes our fellow citizens to think about these issues, even if they'd prefer not to.
Well, Clear Channel has bought up so many stations. This is an act of resistance to defend the public airwaves.
You know, I've been concerned when that $2.3 trillion went missing from the Pentagon, that, as Rumsfeld announced the day before 9/11, that it might have been used to buy up the media all over the country.
Oh, my goodness.
Bill, I want to thank you for coming on the show. I look forward to having you back.
Well, thank you, Jim. I've enjoyed talking with you. Good luck.
Great pleasure. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Thank you all for listening.